All right, so welcome everybody. This is Everybody Hates Cleveland, the podcast. Unfortunately, we're out with I don't know, the historic anchor, which is Jim Pete. So you're gonna have to deal with the awkward conversation driven by Mike Hattery, which is brutal. I'm Mike Hattery, and I'm here with Gage Will, who's been picked up by Bleacher Report on many an occasion and is the star of the Indians blogosphere. I use the word Indians just off the top before we talk significantly. And I'll let Gage get into this, but our view is two things have been beaten to death this offseason: the name change discussion and expenditures. And I think Gage and I align with a lot of people when we talk about expenditures, the Dolans, and Major League Baseball finances in general. But in our view, in trying to be optimistic, we just want to talk about what this roster actually looks like and what we're going to see in 2021. So with that, how you doing, Gage?
I'm good. I don't want to talk about money, that's for sure. They, like you said, that horse has been beaten to death. I'm going to throw this out there. I'm going to make a concerted effort not to call them, just to call them the Cleveland baseball team. And that's just out of my own habits, just to try to drive myself away from using the nickname. I might drop it in a few times, but if you hear me fumbling with it, just throwing that disclaimer out there.
Yeah, obviously it's not our intention to drop it, and I think I'm excited to see where the rebrand goes, and it's just pretty funny, if you looked at the poll the organization sent out about a week ago to fans, it was pretty clear that they're hunting for some sort of input from fans on both what the color scheme is going to look like and what the naming style is going to look like. So I think it implies the organization's actually a little farther away than you would want to see in terms of figuring out a name.
And I think I might have some traditionalists mad at me after this one, but I think if you're going to rebrand, you go all the way and rebrand. We can get into this at a different time, but I love the idea of changing colors and just leaning into something new and just driving away and using that as an opportunity to reposition your organization.
Completely agree. Now, in order to do what we promised, we're going to talk about the baseball team. And I think you can't talk about this baseball team without talking about the Francisco Lindor trade. We'll get into it a little bit. And once again, this is a conceding all the concepts about what is extending Lindor. Tatis just got $340 million. Was it possible for them to pay him? Are the Dolans cheap? Is Major League Baseball broken for small market? We're just throwing it aside. Let's just talk about what happened with that from a roster perspective. They acquire Amed Rosario, Andrés Giménez, Josh Wolf, and Isaiah Green. What was most exciting to you about that deal, and what was most disappointing?
The most exciting thing was that just tagging Andrés Giménez and as part of the deal. Where I stand on Amed Rosario, he's a fun little lotto ticket. He might not ever amount to anything huge, but he could be a great Swiss Army knife. But the real fun is in Andrés Giménez, and that I'm really excited to see how he takes off in late April or whenever he gets that first introduction. What was most disappointing was that you had to attach Carrasco to get to there. From a personal standpoint, the Carrasco thing hurts. He's been one of my favorite pitchers to watch and watch him work through his early issues. That was just such a pivotal time in the creation of this pitching development machine right now. I feel like that's where it kind of really kicked off and spurred. He might have been the first domino. What do you think?
Yeah, that was tough. I mean, I think to me, look, I like Giménez a lot. Wolf and Green, some prospect types can give you really detailed opinion. We just don't have any granular data of them at the professional level, really. They're draft picks largely. There's almost no data. And while they're really interesting to me, those are more lotto tickets from a talent perspective. Anytime Cleveland acquires a pitcher, I think it's like anytime the Dodgers or Rays acquire a position player talent or any talent or ask for them in trade, every team has to say, why do they want this guy? Do we really want to give up on this guy right now? So, I mean, I think that's interesting. But the biggest disappointment to me is that they've really taken the approach that they're just going to go volume every time. We saw this with San Diego, where they They went with a lot of assets. They went with a lot of assets in return. Both San Diego trades, I should say. Both Clevinger or Bauer, those are really broad construct deals. And Franmil is a great return, but once again, you had, you know, three or four secondary pieces from the Reds. Then in, you know, the most recent deal, love Quantrill, love all those pieces. But once again, Owen Miller, Arias, some might argue Arias is a great centerpiece. And then this Mets deal, you go four pieces. It's just one of those situations where with the way the 40-man roster is getting tight, I kind of would have liked to have seen them try and consolidate for just a strong centerpiece and maybe a buy low for one of these organizations where maybe you add an asset or something. But, you know, we have some teams where some prospects struggled early, but they're really young. Like, it would have been interesting to see them try and go after Adele while his value was down, or Lux while his value was down, or, you know, something like that, where you say, let's attack a highly touted centerpiece. But I'm, you know, I think that's my main criticism. But overall, the return wasn't at all surprising to me from an equity perspective based on Lindor's deal and baseball economics this offseason. Did it seem light to you, or did it just seem sort of like in line with what you expected?
I would say when considering adding in Carrasco, it was pretty in line with what I expected. Jimenez, because, I mean, even if you isolate the Carrasco piece, I don't know that Lindor alone gets you Jimenez and Rosario. But I think alone, where does he end up? Jimenez, and maybe Carrasco gets you those extra couple pieces? I'm going to kind of knock back on something you said there. I understand where you're going with the 40-man crunch and the volume side. I don't have as much of an issue with it, because it seems like the org has kind of identified a process of how they want to hit on these deals. And I appreciate that they're sticking to that process. And
yeah, that's a fair point. And, you know, like another counter to my point is, you know, ultimately Arias is a bit of an outlier, but you look at the guys they're acquiring, you look at Cantillo, you look at Wolf and a couple other pitchers, and it's just like, oh, it's that pitchability guy who has strong command of secondary offerings. You know, we've made basically the last 7 years of Indians, of Cleveland professional baseball, excuse me, has been constructed on maximizing those guys that other organizations aren't even turning into fifth starters, and we're turning into second and third starters. So, you know, that approach I get, in the sense that they're saying, you know, we can grab these assets that are undervalued and toss them into larger packages and just go more volume. You see the same with, you know, Owen Miller, and a couple other acquisitions that'll slip my mind right now. Victor Nova, perhaps, where, you know, you have, you know, high contact frequency, low K rates.
He's like
Jimenez as well.
He's like a green piece too. He's just so far away that it's just filler.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So, I mean, you know, one of the counter arguments is I'm interested. The most interesting piece in this deal to me is, you know, Jimenez is, I wrote about this a couple of times, you know, Jimenez is the obvious centerpiece. Like, there's no doubt that dude's a plus defender at short right now. There's contact. There's reason to believe he can be an average to above average offensive player. Like, that's a legit starter 2-3 to 4 war player, potentially. I mean, probably more 2 to 3, but, you know, that makes sense. The one that's really interesting to me is Rosario. And I'm like out on a limb here. I'm a lonely man. I think he's fascinating because this is a pedigree top 10 guy prospect in baseball. And I'm not obsessed with pedigree, and I don't think anyone should be, but there is that. 23-24, he posts a 2.5 to 3 war campaign. His offense finally clicks. He just looks like a solid big leaguer. And last year he sucked. And so it's like, yeah, last year he sucked. It was a 60-game season. Carlos Santana sucked last year. The Royals didn't really put any credence into Carlos Santana sucking last year, and they paid him competently. You know, so to me, it's like, it seems like Rosario, who was really a kick-in to this deal in many ways, actually has a really interesting ceiling, especially if they're willing to deploy him creatively. But that's the question, right? Like, yeah, the best version of this team is Jimenez starts at short day one, probably. And Rosario, probably they say, let's super util you in the infield, do some matchup stuff. And then let's do like center field, go out there like in the spring, 5 hours a day, shag fly balls. Like, that makes the most sense, right? Pure speed, utilize him, solid tools. And their center field options are, I like Oscar Mercado, but he is no power, and Bradley Zimmer has not hit anything that is not, like, attached to the earth in about 5 years.
I'm at the point with center field where I'm going to be disappointed if it's not Daniel Johnson or Amed Rosario.
I don't know.
I like Oscar Mercado, and he's another one where if you just throw out 2020, there are a lot of other concerns with Mercado. It's not like you can just dismiss 2020 because he couldn't put a bat on the ball.
Yeah, and so like Mercado is one of those cases too where a lot of those guys won't get second chances, right? Like, it's like the bat, we doubted the bat forever, which is why the Indians were able, why the team was able to acquire him in the first place. Apologies. And then we had some like breakout, but even his breakout season, if you looked at the underlying data, you were like, ah, this is smoke and mirrors. And I like Mercado a lot. I hyped him at the time. I wanted him to get an opportunity. And I still think he has a role on a big league roster. But the bat, I think, you know, like the real questions that we had and lack of confidence in its sustainability, you know, it's pretty much shown out. What are the odds Rosario plays more than 10 games in center field?
This is that Terry Francona question. I'm not going to turn this into a let's dunk on Francona type thing, but it's really hard to trust that he's going to – it's going to be weird to say because he put Jason Kipnis out there in center field in the playoffs, and he put Carlos Santana in the corner outfield in the playoffs. He used Andrew Miller how he should be used, and that's what leveraged them to a World Series appearance. I don't have a ton of faith that he will do that with a young guy, though. That's where the hang up occurs for me. I would say that there's a 20% chance that Rosario plays more in the outfield than he does in the infield. Unless there's some significant Francona shakeup, I think he'll be used as that Swiss Army knife to let Jose Ramirez go DH for a day, or maybe bump, I don't know who you bump over to third, but just theoretically just bounce Rosario around the infield. And they're kind of in a weird position where they don't have a bunch of first base options, so it doesn't hurt that much to put Rosario in that in that spot of the lineup by bumping somebody off or over. You'll, like, for example, giving Jimenez the day off and then throwing Rosario at short and then bumping Naylor to first. And then all of a sudden you got another at bat for Daniel Johnson. I think you can get creative like that. I could see Francona doing that, but I can't see him saying, okay, Amed, you're our center fielder for the month of June. Let's see how it goes.
So, like, let's talk about this. I for one, was pretty surprised that Francona in the post-Lindor world and the post-Carrasco world was like, hey, I'm coming off a year of serious health issues where I could barely get back in the dugout. I want to coach this team. And I want to manage this team. And, you know, he's well compensated, but the man's been well compensated for a long time, so I'm not super worried about his retirement savings. I guess expectations are fascinating here, and I'm worried that expectations are going to hurt them, or their competency will hurt them, because their competency will drive certain managerial decisions that will hurt their future. And my point is, I think – the rotation, if it stays healthy, the offense will be a tick better. The bullpen, by every measure, I think should be competent, average to above average. It's probably one of the highest ceiling bullpens in Cleveland since Miller and Allen were good 4 years ago. I mean, I think Hand was very good at one point, but, you know, Clase and Karinchak has real, like, best reliever in baseball ceiling. You have Henkes, who's close. You have a lot of secondary pieces, and Phil Maton is really undervalued, but, like, you know, there are all these pieces to them being solid. And what happens when they're solid is some people like to trust the vets. And the most important part of this season from a team building perspective to me is that I want to know a lot more about Andrés Giménez. I want to know a lot more about Amed Rosario. I want to know a lot more about Bo Naylor. I want to know a lot more about Owen Miller,
Josh Naylor,
Tyler Freeman, potentially. Are you worried that their competence will cost us understanding of what the next 3 to 5 years of Cleveland baseball will look like?
Yeah. I mean, they just went out and gave him Ben Gamel as a piece that could. And I want to mention here that in any other scenario, I'm perfectly okay with throwing an invite to Ben Gamel and Billy Hamilton. He's just a different beast, but those are the types of guys that Francona has historically given chances out there. Ben Gamel is Melky Cabrera redux. Is that what that is? Melky was probably a better hitter.
So he was a better hitter. It's a good point.
And I, like I said, I don't hate the Gamel thing in isolation. I just don't know where it fits on this team. And obviously it's just a minor league deal. So maybe he's just a body in spring to fill out one of the B roster, the A roster.
I went on a thing recently on the Twitter sphere, which was, I really used to believe that there were no bad minor league contracts until I watched Terry Francona manage. And I maintain that. I think, and as a joined our addendum to this assertion would be Delino DeShields, who obviously not a minor league signing, but was fluffed to a deal and like is no longer a major league rosterable player other than a fringe player, played like a starter last year when the team really needed to find out, you know, what was Daniel Johnson. A counter argument to that would be, well, it's obvious they don't think Daniel Johnson's very much because they're playing Delino DeShields over him. Is that a reasonable counter, or can we reject that counter as insufficient?
Hold on. You can't rush 25-year-olds, okay?
Hey, man, service time. We got to talk about if I hear one person talk about, like, service time with 25-year-olds, I'm going to be like, they don't care about that. They didn't care about service time with Yandy Diaz. That's why they didn't hold him back. They didn't hold him back because Francona didn't like the effort he put in on defensive reps in practice. It didn't have to do anything to do with his service time. Service time for 25-year-olds, teams do not care about age 32 seasons. Done. Off the table. Move
Especially
on.
When we were talking about Karinchak last year. It's like, it's a reliever. You get 3 or 4 good years of him, and then you're done. Look at Cody Allen, who I adored as an Indian. But relievers, elite relievers fall off. They weren't worried about James Karinchak's age 31 season. They weren't worried about Daniel Johnson's age 31 season, but they gave him 13 plate appearances. And we know Francona wasn't on the bench, but Sandy Alomar was an extension of him last summer. So I am terrified that there's going to be Gamel and Billy Hamilton blocking these plate appearances.
So let's talk about probably one of the most Twitter maligned characters of the 2020 campaign, Jordan Luplow, who like is probably one of the least discussed Cleveland outfielders right now. I think everybody's like, oh, I'm really interested in what Naylor's going to do. Josh Naylor's going to look like. I think I called him Bo earlier because, you know, I love his brother, who's a catching prospect in the organization as well. And I'm much higher on him than others. And I think he's a legit top 100 prospect. We'll come back to that later. Everybody wants to see Franmil. They want to see Naylor. Johnson's really interesting. I certainly want to see Johnson get an opportunity. I think one of the big keys is actually, you know, Luplow showed real promise and real productivity in 2019. In a shortened 2020 season, he had some matchup issues and wasn't great.
But he was coming out of it, too. Right at the end of that year, he was starting to smoke the ball. I don't know if it materialized in results, but I remember a series in Chicago where he just blasted everything.
So let's talk about our platonic ideal of a Cleveland outfield, no trades, acquisitions. You know, how does it line up? And let's use percentages for playing time at position. So, you know, left field, who is getting 90%? Is somebody getting 90% of the playing time, or is it going to be really amorphous?
I would think, well, that's kind of a double-edged sword because it depends on where Josh Naylor is, right? In Cleveland, you want to play Josh Naylor in left field. I have no doubt about that. Even if Eddie Rosario is not a great defender, but I would play him in right over Naylor. But either way, let's just, for argument's sake, let's say Eddie Rosario is playing right field. I think he will play 90% plus of the corner outfield reps. Then you move over to center where it's just a mess. And it really just depends on who latches on, because I think Oscar Mercado is probably going to get the first crack. I would say in my ideal world, I'd have Daniel Johnson out there for 90% of reps, or until he had a significant number of plate appearances where he proved he couldn't do it. And I want to say Daniel Johnson should be able to play center fine. He's toolsy. He's fast. He's got a cannon of an arm. He makes good reads from all the minor league reports I've read. Center field is a different beast, but I would think that he'd be the prototype that would fit in and work out there.
So the one thing that's been interesting for me is this is a team that has actually kind of prioritized up the middle defense the last few years and not corner defense, while having some of the highest strikeout rate pitching staffs in baseball, and some of the heaviest pull rates in baseball as a product of the launch angle adjustments and the, you know, contact angle adjustments, which would sort of mute up the middle defense. And it seems that they're continuing in this direction. Is that strange to you at all? Because that's strange to me. I don't understand. Like, Johnson to me makes sense in center because they have a staff that gets a solid chunk of strikeouts, and the league is pull heavy. So center field should actually be a lower frequency spot than it has been. Like, if you look at the number of opportunities up the middle of the diamond over the last 15 years, it's just a downward curve. Why wouldn't you do someone like Daniel Johnson in center?
Especially because as more outfield shifts become prominent, like, you can slide him anywhere, and he's used to playing right field. He's used to playing pretty much everywhere, both of the corners. His arm can play from either of the gaps. Like, you could really use him as that flex center fielder that you shift over towards the gaps towards the right center field gap for pull happy lefties. And you know, he can get that throw to third base. So I don't know why you wouldn't, but then you have a guy like Mercado, who's kind of the opposite, where he's lightning quick, but not a cannon for an arm. He's more of your old school center fielder, right? It seems like, I agree. They really seem to turn a corner and start prioritizing defense all of a sudden out there. Especially, I mean, there's no other way you can justify playing Delino DeShields, even if he wasn't great defensively. I think it's kind of a strange fit. I agree with you.
All right, let's talk corners, because I think this is the messiest part of Cleveland baseball, and one that, and you sort of allocated, and they have a collection of decisions to make that I think are really difficult. So in the near term, opening day, you need to find at bats, and let's just say you lock Rosario into a corner. He has the most outfield experience. We're not, you know, that's off the table. You have Naylor and Franmil. First, you have to pick which one of those seemingly apathetic defenders you want to defend left field and which one you want to put at first base or DH, right? So it seems like we're saying, Franmil's probably a DH, even though he doesn't want to be. Naylor's probably a left fielder. What gets messier is when you start tossing in, they have to make some first base choices, and they have to make some prospect choices. So the three names that immediately come to mind are, in terms of likelihood of being good, Nolan Jones is blocked at third base, has knocks on his third base defense, has a hose for an arm, and is pretty athletic. So he probably, they try him in a corner outfield spot. You have Bowers and Bobby Bradley. You have to find PAs for Reyes and those five, ultimately, or you have to give up on a couple of them probably, right?
I've been treating Bowers and Bradley, or Jake Bowers and Bobby Bradley, as kind of a tandem, because I'm not convinced that both of them will be on this 40-man roster when this season starts. Mm-hmm. I don't, there's becoming a 40-man crunch where they have to hold on to a couple relievers and arms that they like and a third catcher, it almost makes sense that we might see a Bobby Bradley or a Jake Bauer sent out the door late spring training. That's kind of feels like the direction that we're headed right now.
So I think so too. And I think the obvious guy they probably cut bait on first, probably Bowers. I'm not saying that's what I do. I'm saying from a, I think you mentioned this on Twitter. We've discussed this previously. There are some how well Bowers worked with the organization to make adjustment things that kind of reached the surface publicly, which is really bad because the organization never really wants to do those things publicly unless they absolutely have to press that lever, because it's just devaluing one of your own assets essentially. So I mean, my view would, it would probably be Bowers. I'm probably more optimistic about Bowers as a professional, though obviously the work ethic probably undermines that and his ability to tap into other school skills if they're criticizing his work ethic. But do you think Bradley gets cut?
I don't think so. I'm like I said, I'm with you, and then I'm probably more optimistic on Bowers than most, but it's still kind of half a dozen of one and six of the other to me. One of them is, and I would honestly probably, even if he is a unicorn, like he struck out over 30% of the time in AAA, Bobby Bradley, that is, he's probably got more upside if he found. And I think that you could talk me into that decision based on that alone. And like I said, I've been higher on Jake Bowers than most, but as you said, the organization doesn't let that stuff bubble much. And it was actually through Terry Francona, if I recall correctly. And it didn't seem like Francona was offhand on that. It seemed pretty calculated.
Yeah.
Like, let's send a message to this kid.
I'm a noted, there were times where I was really high on Bradley for agent level production. And in the early minors, he gave you really strong signs for like a raw 19 and 20 year old who made real strides, you know, and I've obviously the last two or three years have built somewhat of a large investment firm around shorting Bobby Bradley because he just doesn't make a lot of contact and not just in ways. He looks fundamentally overmatched against breaking stuff at times to me, but I will concede, like, obviously the ceiling is higher. I think you would keep him over Bowers, and I think it's worth the gamble. I think the odds of us reaching a point where he's like an impact bat are like sub 1%. I think the odds of him being, a good enough bat to play first base are maybe 10 or 15%. Like, and that's I think people need to understand that playing first base offensively is a really high threshold, and you can do it for a year in Cleveland when they haven't spent any money or resources to put someone at first base. But, you know, like Casey Koshman was supposedly an elite defender at first base, but if you can't be 10% above league average offensively, you're a replacement level first baseman. That's just the standard. And these guys, it's hard to get there.
Yeah. And it's not like we're talking about giving up on, both these guys project to be below average offensively right now. And so I don't think by saying let's take the guy with the higher ceiling, granted, I might pick Bowers. I'm not saying that I wouldn't, but I think by saying, okay, let's take the higher ceiling guy because neither of these options are that great. And it's only going to be a temporary thing anyway. Whenever Nolan Jones comes up in June, we can hopefully put him in right field and then Josh Naylor can handle first base or something like that. So I think it's going to be one of those two if you start the season with Naylor in a corner, in the opposite corner of Rosario. I think it's going to be either Bobby Bradley or Bowers, and they're going to have a month and a half or a two-month audition, basically until that extra year of Nolan Jones kicks in June or whatever it is, which I don't agree with, but you could sell me on the argument that we want Nolan Jones to play corner outfield for a couple months before throwing him into the fire. But man, he is one of those pieces that could really take this team from an 82 win team to an 86 win team and right in the thick of the.
His offensive floor to me And look, I'm wrong. Every prospect has risk. Every big league player has risk of not repeating. And I think we don't discuss enough like sustainability of big league players. Like, look, every prospect has risk. I'll hedge myself. I'll hedge for 30 minutes here. My point is, I think his floor is really high. I'm not sure how high the Nolan Jones ceiling is because I'm not sure if he's going to put the ball in play enough to really access the power enough to become a dominant big league hitter. But I think he can be, I think I'm very confident he'll be average to slightly above average very soon, which is huge for this lineup. And in part because, you know, last year we watched a lineup that had what, three average or above big league hitters, which is why it was one of the five worst in baseball. Let's talk briefly at the end here. We both expect this offense to be better. We both expected this offense to be better without Eddie Rosario being signed because it was unsustainably bad, right?
Right. You're not going to get a 20 weighted runs created plus output from your catchers again, no matter how poor batsmanship Hedges and Perez typically are. That's just not going to happen. Maybe 50, but that's a huge boost to one spot in your lineup right there. And your outfield's not going to be a below 50 weighted runs created plus outfield either. Eddie Rosario out there should guarantee that pretty much. I agree with your point on Nolan Jones, and I want to make a point that those high walk guys, I think I have a theory that they have higher floors. So Nolan Jones strikes out a lot, but he also walks a ton. So if he can run into the extra base hit here and there and walk 12% of the time, then there's an average hitter right there.
Yeah, no, it's, I think that's why I'm so confident in his floor. When you, I mean, in the minors, he's running, you know, 18, 20% walk rates. That's not happening in the bigs. That's going to winnow itself down to, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15%. We'll see where it stabilizes and that'll be important. But that component plus the raw power, where if you walk, you know, 12% of the time and hit 20 home runs, it's really easy to be above league average offensively. You're going to have some really weird stuff. You're going to have to strike out 40% of the time, probably, or 35% to not be sustainable. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think one of the positives, too, you look at his underlying data, you look at his swinging strike data, he's not swinging and missing a ton in the minors. His swinging strike data is actually pretty decent, especially when you consider age and level. So I think that's really positive. You know, one last thing that I, one last point, and this is not dogging Francisco Lindor. He's a great player. I hope he's great with the Mets and I hope he makes the Hall of Fame. Good for him. I love trolling about Ramirez being better because the man just is. But the most important thing to me is replacing his 2020 production is not super hard, and replacing a league average bat is not super hard. And that's what they have to do with Lindor. So the offensive player that moved away, I think for them is way easier to replace than the pitcher they lost.
You're talking
we'll
about,
talk about that soon.
You're talking about Santana too, who was not especially good last year. And I love Carlos Santana, but he was a below average. I think he finished a below average hitter. So you had an average, a very pedestrian year from Lindor and Santana in addition to those catcher and outfield woes. It was unsustainably bad offense last year. I'm not saying they'll be a good offense, but I would bet money on them being better this year offensively.
So let's close with a quick over-under game. Last year, there were 26 in offense in baseball. I think what Gage and I would both agree on is they're probably not average unless a bunch of stuff goes right offensively. If you are going to say, if we're going to say 20th in baseball, are they going to be better than 20th in baseball offensively, or are they going to be worse than 20th in baseball offensively?
I would probably bet worse, but not much. That's right around where I would think. What about you?
I think that's the number. All right, I'm gonna try and wrap this up as smoothly as possible because I never do this quite as well as Jim. But please come back. We promise we'll podcast. It's unfortunate that we live busy lives. Jim is teaching like an absolute saint and giving up a lot of time. Gage has some wonderful children, a wonderful wife, and a demanding job, and is you know, in grad school, which is fun. And I'm just, well, you know, a lawyer, and I get lazy at night. And I go to bed weirdly early sometimes. That's problematic. But listen to Everybody Hates Cleveland, the podcast. We're going to try and roll out those position player previews that we did for like 3 years and run down everything because we have a lot of stuff to say. And, you know, we're pretty convinced some people need to hear it.
That's all. give us 5 stars on iTunes if you could. We would appreciate it. We can't compete with those other Indians pods, but keep coming back and we'll get you. Peace.